beginning to separate from AID in a sense, because you're part of the village and becoming more like a villager and less.
I never saw myself that way. I really never did.
But you realize that that was the way to get things done, was to find out what they needed, because you had your original entry into the country and you say, well, they need this, and then pretty soon you throw that away.
Yes. Because that was just from my perspective and my view. I mean, that was like what I thought we should be done.
Yeah.
And I didn't need them. Okay.
You didn't
I didn't need to talk to them.
Right.
It's like Ellis in the book, you know, the invisible man, you know.
Uh-huh.
Aha. I've seen this remote village before. Here's what they need.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to talk to them. They become invisible. All they are is just this... this
recipient group.
Exactly. I know everything I need to know. I have experience in this area. And it was a realization that I didn't know squat.
Uh-huh.
That in fact, what really might be necessary or used there, I mean, this is a long process that continued, that kind of thinking continued for me all right up to the end, and just mm-hmm. how limited or how narrow or what opportunities one might have to, say, positively influence. And I mean that word seriously. We influenced them in many, many ways,
mm-hmm.
most of which were negative, but they're mm-hmm. very resilient. They have an old culture. They're used mm-hmm. to having strangers come in and beat up on them or do things to them that aren't nice, and they seem to be able to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but there is a place. I don't know that I ever found it in Laos, but I certainly found it in Thailand, as to what contributions one could make, you know, from my position and so on. And it's a very narrow area, and it's one in which they have to ask for it, and if they don't ask for it, it doesn't do any good for you to do whatever you want to do.
Okay.
That kind of thing, you know?
Okay, so perhaps...
So I wasn't rejecting. It was a realization that we're wasting our time here.
Yeah, with that approach.
That's correct.
Yeah. So it wasn't necessarily that you were becoming a villager, but you were becoming much more attuned to the needs of the village and letting them tell you what they needed so that you could respond more effectively.
We could probably talk at that point without me telling.
Yeah.
And I could listen, and their problems and the things that they would like to see were things that I couldn't do anything about.
Uh-huh.
As in, why is this war going on?
Yeah.
You know, or we need, you know, our village is running out of land.
Mm-hmm.
Those kinds of things. I mean, very, very, their population, this, regardless of the AID influence, was this penicillin, for example. It was just saving lives left and right. And so the population problems were becoming acute in a sense. And so people were still having the same number of children, but they weren't dying.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. And that was just a general thing that we didn't have any. And roads were being built, and money was coming into the area.
Changing their lives.
And changing their lives. And Japanese imports of radios and,
mm-hmm.
and people were interested in Laos, and they hadn't been before.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Except for a few neighboring kings. Or the French would use it as a chess piece.
They were really looking at it, and they really didn't bother the villages. I mean, they were not in the village.
Right.
And see, this is an incursion in there that cost, and you know, pushed this thing a little bit further by simply assigning us to the village, because there never been anybody around there like that.
Mm-hmm.
We were the first. They never got a chance to talk to an American in their life, or anybody that was foreign in that sense.
Yeah.
Only, you know, beyond their. Maybe Vietnamese or Lao or Thai or Chinese.
Occasional
or
Chinese merchant.
Exactly.
Yeah. But not a French administrator.
No.
Or even a French citizen.
Yeah. And here I was just this young guy, you know, sitting around there saying, this is what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And are you going to do this for, you know, this kind of thing? No. This is just, an opportunity to come and visit with you. That's all I used to say to him. I said, we've come to visit and learn about you, and you learn about us as much as you can. And to the degree that we can do this is... why I'm here.
But they did ask you those difficult questions, like, or present those difficult needs, like, we need more land. or
not,
can
no, you? No, they didn't really say that to me. They would lament that after a while because they're realizing that what the tradition was that when a father and mother, mm-hmm. usually a father had lands and stuff, it was divided up among his sons. Well, they don't have enough land to divide up anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and because of the size of the population, more animals had to be killed, so there wasn't enough buffalo, for example, to till the fields. What shall we do? You know, and they had used not a slash and burn in that area, but primarily it was just like come in, cut the trees down so they could put their fields in, their nas, their, you know, dikes around, and then mm-hmm. plant their rice and stuff. Like, it just wasn't much land left that they hadn't already been over a couple of times. So it was just there was a time there, you know, which things were happening.
Okay, and what another thing that they, you said that they said was about the war itself.
Yeah. Yeah. Just couldn't figure out why this war was going on.
Did they want an explanation, or did they want you to see what you could do to stop it?
No, it was never that. It was just going on. At the same time that we were in the village, there might be a CIA guy working with the army camp, which was off in another village fairly close. And they had recruited people out, and there was a home guard with M1s and that sort of thing, and a lot of weapons were being distributed.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know that there was many people who were killed accidentally with these weapons and stuff like that, but periodically there would be an ambush of, say, there was like a home guard thing, and so they were on duty part of the time. There'd be an ambush somewhere, and several people would be killed.
Uh-huh.
Several men would be killed, and it was that anguish of, why is this happening? I mean, they didn't do anything. They never fired a round. They were just, you know, they were just earning some money. You know, it's sort of like they did this because they were enticed to do so, because it offered them an opportunity to earn a few kip. You know,
and then they
people.
Discovered.
And they discovered that, it isn't even a discovery. They're very realistic. They never complain. I never had any hostility there about that kind of stuff. I got more of that from Vietnamese, and that was more in the educated groups. You know, as you're in the bigger towns like Pak Sa Vietnam, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. where people would actually confront you at times when you'd sit and talk with them and wonder why you weren't fighting in the war. Why wasn't I fighting in the war?
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't you fighting in the war? This is not my war. It's your war, he'd say. This wouldn't be going on if it wasn't for you people, you know, that kind of thing. You're tearing my country to pieces.
How would you respond to that?
I had no answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
I had no answer to that. Anyway, not an aside, but just to go ahead on this. So I spent about two-thirds of my tour in La Compagne, and then a fellow named Hafner organized a forward area something. And so several of us volunteered for this thing, and they were going to take us and assign us into. You get that?
Oh yeah, that's the phone. Oh
yeah,
it's got a strange ring.
Yeah.
Pause. Okay, before Connie called, I put this back on.
Okay.
Before Connie called, you were talking about this Colonel Hafner.
Yes.
And his forward area program.
Forward area program. That's what it was called.
Who was Colonel Hafner?
Yeah, he was a retired Marine Colonel.
Okay. So
AID.
So he was continuing.
Well, we called him Colonel.
Kind of as an honorific rather than because he was still in the
service. No, he was not in the service.
Yeah.
And he was just a terrific
mm-hmm.
guy. I mean, you know, just that stereotype of that really great leader type
uh-huh.
thing. And anyway, he just came to a number of us and said, would you like to join my program? And the concept was to put us as a sort of a further impact program, you know, just zoom us into certain areas that we were very concerned about and see if we couldn't impact those areas and bring some kind of presence. You know, that was a big deal over there at that point, of just letting the villagers know that we cared about them, so therefore when the ideological tug of war took place, they would
remember
go
this
on
with,
our side. Yeah, something
with fond
like
hearts.
Yes, yeah, so we got flown in and jumped off in places at times and set up our little camp. And
jumped off?
On a helicopter. Not jumped off.
Oh, okay.
You know, I jumped out of a helicopter, and we dragged our stuff off the helicopter.
I thought maybe you were parachuting in.
No, nothing like that.
Like the flying Elvises or something.
No, it wasn't like that. And
okay.
And we were never really in any place of any very duration. I don't know that it had any impact whatsoever. It was just kind of a thing that you do with young people and tell them, you know, you're going to do great things. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, it's like being in the service in a way. Mm-hmm. You know. Private Green climb this wall. Okay, yes, sir. You know, I mean, it was that type of being part of the team, all mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. You know, and Half was such a neat guy, and he really was. It was just an idea that he had, and it was looking for some of us that were a little bored. I got put into Cerevon at that point in that type of program. You know, just to. And we spent about 6 months over there. And there was another Peace Corps volunteer from Nepal who was hired by AID as a sort of a field advisor or something like that. It worked with me. It's a fellow from I don't know where he was from, Oregon, but he went to school at Grinnell College in Iowa.
Okay.
His name was Stu During, and he was Peace Corps Nepal. We sat in Cerevon for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Did all kinds of surveys in the villages all around there and traveled
as
all
part of the Forward program.
Yeah, Forward, yeah.
But Hafner, was he AID or IVF?
He was AID.
Oh, he was AID, okay. So he left the military and then joined AID?
Yes, yeah, clearly. He retired from the Marines.
Uh-huh, okay.
The guy was, that's where I can see where, you know, what was the role of Chief Party? You know, there's a lot of stuff. You know, it's kind of what administratively it was a nightmare, I'm sure, trying to figure out who's reporting to who. And it was always a contest over there to see, should we send our monthly reports to our aid guy who was directly supervising us, or should we send it to our chief of party and all that kind of stuff. We really never worried about that too much because we never put too much in the monthly reports anyhow, you know, in a sense. I mean, it was just a requirement that we had to do.
So where'd you send them?
We did both.
You just made two copies?
We sent them to Vientiane, or we just, you know, they could do whatever they wanted to with them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it was a question of whether we worked for the chief of party or whether we worked for AID. I mean, that was never clearly stated to us.
Yeah.
You know, it was pretty mixed up.
Yeah, did Hafner talk to...
We worked for Hafner when we worked for Hafner.
Yeah, but did he clear out this... with IVS? And
oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, there wasn't any. And they kind of turned us over. I mean, that was Chet Brown, in a sense. That was happening after, you know, during that time. And mm-hmm. I just, you know, it was like we basically worked for AID at that time. And none of us liked that because we didn't. You know, we were volunteers. We were over there for a lot of different purposes and reasons and that.
Mm-hmm.
Which didn't exclude working with AID, but certainly wasn't what we were doing. You know, I mean, I didn't have to answer, and they couldn't tell me what to do per se if I disagreed with them.
Uh huh.
That kind of thing.
But yet, Chet Brown said, "Okay, you can
Chet
have
Brown
these
never
guys.
Said a thing.
Yeah,
he must have said it to Hafner because Hafner told it to us, and we never got any real. I don't remember reading anything that said. We're now having an administrative change here or something.
Yeah,
like
yeah. Or we've got this new program where and retired Colonel Hafner is going to be in charge of it. I want you volunteers to consider if you want to join out.
It was nothing like that. He came and talked to us personally.
He did.
Yeah.
Hafner
did.
But not Brown.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Okay. So
that was, you know, that's just an administrative thing. And it wasn't something totally, I mean, most of us were, you know, unguided missiles anyway, a little bit, you know, and we used that. We aren't that way quite, but we felt we were sort of immune
mm-hmm.
from the goings on, the normal goings on. We didn't have administrative responsibilities for these folks, so, you know, they could tell us, well, don't go into this area because it's really insecure and stuff like that. Well, what do they know? We're on the village level. We got all these, you know, people that are around us. If it was really bad, they'd tell us. You know, that kind of thing. Which is totally naive. Totally.
Well,
and we thought that we were immune and they could tell the difference. You know, the Viet Cong, or not the Viet Cong, but the Pathet Lao would be able to tell the difference between those of us who were really in there to help the people and those that were in there to sell an ideology or something, which we weren't doing. We were completely neutral. We were just there to help the people, you know. And that kind of persistent view, I felt, was where probably the biggest error that was made by IBS, you say to whoever, you know, that actually could have prevailed. We just didn't. And I'm not even sure they didn't tell us.
They probably did,
but we just didn't listen, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'm still thinking of Chet Brown, because I've heard that he wasn't really... Oh, I don't know how I want to put this, because I don't want to sound nasty, but that he didn't have his, let's say, tight a control of things as Walt Cloward did.
He wasn't a really good administrator. He's an Indiana farmer, dairy farmer.
Mm-hmm.
Came out because he and his wife just wanted to do something like we did.
Uh-huh.
And he should have been in the field somewhere, probably.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have any real experience in dealing with bureaucrats. I mean, AIT is a bureaucracy, believe me.
Sure.
They are unbelievable.
Sure.
I mean, that was another whole story, you know.
So basically a lot of the program was kind of abrogated to...
And it was true even when Walt was there.
As well.
It was true. It was very difficult to decide, to know whether... In these cluster programs, I mean, we're so tightly tied to I forget what they're called. Area coordinator was sort of one in Poxa and one in Bien-Chan, one in Vaughan-Devon.
Uh-huh.
And then there were people under him who were in the next chain of command, and that was the guy or the woman who was telling us what to do in the cluster programs.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, it was a guy named Bruce Bailey,
mm-hmm.
who was killed in Vietnam. Eventually, he transferred over there and was killed. But they always had somebody assigned to the area that we were in, and AID. And there was always a lot of conflict there.
We're kind of conflict.
Well, they thought they should be able to tell us what to do, and they always thought that we were, you know, like running and doing whatever we wanted to do.
We were.
Yeah, we probably were.
Yeah. maybe in hindsight they were right.
But there's an interesting story. This area coordinator named John McQueen was the area coordinator in Poxa. He became the area coordinator in Udon. Okay, in Laos, in Thailand.
And
that's where I was assigned in Northeast Thai, in the Thai National Police Department, the border police there. And he told somebody, and he knew me pretty well, but he said to somebody, he says, gosh, he's really come along a long way since he was a volunteer. And I hadn't done any changes at all. You know, the basic change had been that I had moved from a volunteer status into a...
Paid position,
right?
Yeah.
It was the same. I think it was essentially the same person. And we became actually quite close friends.
Okay.
You know, because he no longer held the view of me, you know, being this sort of a volunteer, you know.
Just the status alone supposedly brought all this other stuff with it.
Yeah.
When it didn't.
Yeah, and yeah, this is an Ellison thing, invisible man type thing.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And there wasn't any way I was going to change that because that's of my status. But once I went over to Laos, or to Thailand, and worked over there, we were good buddies. And I was so surprised about that because I figured that'd be old baggage I'd have to deal with over there. And it just never happened.
Mm-hmm.
Just never happened, and I was very pleased about that. But it was also a learning experience about realizing that's the way bureaucracies work. I mean, it has a lot to do with what position you're in and how they treat you and that kind of stuff, which was...
Just like later, if you have a corner office with windows
on two
sides, or you're a lot better off than a guy with no windows in the center of this
great
building.
Effect, yeah. And we used to see IBS volunteers, for example, who would finish their tours and would be hired on contract hire with aid and would turn against IBS. Never understood that.
Really?
You know, yeah, it would become quite hostile.
No kidding.
Yeah, it happened quite often.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't know that it happened often.
Yeah.
Can you think of some examples of how they did it?
Well, they would just start bad-mouthing IDSers and how they can't be controlled and we don't want to deal with them. You know, we got to do this program ourselves. You know, it wasn't directed to me directly, but I heard the guy say it. Mm-hmm. I was so surprised about that because he was the one that was bitching about, for example, about aid people.
Oh, no.
You know, that kind of thing. So it's just, it's kind of like a... whose ox is being gored, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, but that's an aside. But people are like, I mean, that wasn't a huge revelation or anything, but it was just kind of an irony that you know. I mean, it was like, it's the thing like I had mentioned about, you know, people who were going native or something like that and saw themselves as having this very distinct role as, say, an IVSer, and this is what IVSers do. Well, in this group that we were in, IVSers do a lot of different things. Some, you know, went like you could hardly differentiate them from AID people. I mean, they reported directly to AID people, and they did AID work. And they were grooming themselves to go right into contract hire. Mm-hmm. Others would keep themselves completely isolated and would operate within the village and teach school, you know, teach classes in English and do whatever, and basically function as a volunteer, like a VISTA volunteer or something, or a Peace Corps volunteer. And have very little to do with it. So, I mean, and that was probably a fault in a sense, but if you didn't have direction, inner direction, you'd be, you know, kind of lost in all.
Inner direction, or also in this case, maybe more direction from the VNTN office.
Right.
You know, particularly under Brown.
Well, it was true with Walt, too. I know Walt was dissatisfied with the way it was. It was just an inherent part of the way the contract was written, you know. You could see the positive aspects of just implementing those programs and being in touch with that, but at the same time, it became clear that, you know, we had no business doing a lot of stuff that we were doing.
Such as what?
Oh, just the way we elicited our programs and stuff. We didn't have to ask them. We just went through the motions. I mean, if you really wanted to help villagers, for example, you'd have to spend some time in there so that they would be believed. I mean, you just couldn't walk in and ask anybody. You'd have to get, there's a system there for making decisions in the village. Mm-hmm. We never tapped that.
Uh-huh.
They didn't know about it.
They meaning?
Like, for example, I was describing how I witnessed this death and childbirth, okay? What's the process that went through as to who would get this child? It's there. It's not just somebody doesn't come in and just pick up the child and go.
Yeah.
See, we never really explored, I mean, we never really became aware of those or never pursued those. We never had to check that out. We just came in, we assumed the head man runs the village. Well, that isn't necessarily so.
Mm-hmm.
He might be just stinting that time because it's his turn.
Yeah.
But the real person isn't, you know, maybe the head of the watch or something such thing. You know? I mean, we went right by the book, in a sense. And if we dispense
the nice organization chart,
exactly what was given to us
by Max Weber.
Be sure, yeah, exactly. Good sociologist you are.
Yes.
So that, you know, and the idea is that you really have to spend some time in there to find out that that's what that is, and they won't reveal it to you because they know it, but that isn't necessarily anything written down. So that if you wanted to find out what they wanted, chances are they will tell you, but it's probably not something you're capable of doing, which, as I mentioned earlier.
Well, you've got to ask the right questions, but you don't know the right questions to ask.
That's correct. And you don't know what that response is. And you know, because when you start getting into that, they don't necessarily, you know, ask you directly either. They're not used to asking people from the outside for anything. It's usually very dire consequences happen, you know, when things come from the outside and they take care of themselves. Like I mentioned earlier, you know, where we had a murder in the village. And I mean, the idea of bringing the police into the village just to help solve this or do that, I mean, you know, we know who killed him, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It isn't the problem. So the problem is, what are we going to do about it?
When you say, let's get the police, they look at you like, no.
Yeah, I mean, this is absurd. That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard, you know, that kind of thing. It's not so much that the police won't know what to do. We know what to do because we know who did it and we know why I did it and so on, and we know what we want done. And so why would you need to bring in that? So, I mean, they never looked to the outside of their village for any... Yeah, because they didn't know what's going on. They never looked outside the village because that person never would be able to help them much. They'd solve their own problems. And so they ended up taking care of this in a very, you know, enlightened way in terms of the way they, you know... Guy divvied up his land and made damn sure that these children of this guy were cared for and so on.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And he agreed. And he could go on doing his thing. You know, but he had a burden to, you know, to take care of these children and so on. You know? So that kind of structure was in there. And I think if they would have, I think we got these things, but they were not in line with what we had already ordered from the States and were giving, like this big program. I mean, they would have never asked for this. Already had one. This upgrading program, you know, there was already a guy that came through and did this for them. Of course, right. He got pick of the litter, see?
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't ask for anything. That kind of thing. And you owed him, you know, something, and we gave it away for nothing.
Do you think that was a good idea?
Ours? To do the pig program?
No. To give something without asking for something in return.
Yeah, I think it's a, I think it's a bad idea in any situation. I mean, and to give something that's, I do. Thinking that it's somehow something they need. If you want to give something to somebody, give it to them. Because you have it to give.
Yeah.
But that wasn't how we gave it. We gave it because we saw that if we crossbred these pigs, we'd have a 50% increase. Their litters would be bigger. They would be stronger pigs and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they were desirable. That kind of thing. You know.
As part of the program.
As part of if you join this program, you know, and so on. And you, mm-hmm. all you have to do is just work with us. And,
mm-hmm.
and the whole thing was based on an assumption that we're going to win the hearts and minds of people by doing things. It's a civic action program.
Yeah. But if they have to contribute something towards the project, you'll find out real fast if they think that it has any chance of working.
In part, and in this, at the same time, they never asked for this, so why would we be offering it? See, that's what you have. I mean, I used to talk mm-hmm. to Christian Catholics, missionaries, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. Tremendous problem. Nobody's asking them for it. To be saved, you know?
Yeah.
So what do they use? They use medicine, they use, you know, different types of programs, education, that kind of thing, to be able mm-hmm. to entice people to want that, and this is what comes
and
along with it.
And then they give them the pitch.
Yeah. Well, that's what comes along with it, yeah.
Yeah.
Or they try to tie into some mystical belief that they have, or, you know, something that's already in the village, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So a very devious sort of way to approach this thing. I mean, you have to be damn sure that it's worth it to impose it on somebody else? I mean, why would you want white pigs? You never asked that question, see? We just assumed that you did,
mm-hmm.
see? We assumed they wanted more rice. We assumed they wanted everything that we offered.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't find any basis for any of those assumptions.
Kind of discouraging, isn't it?
Well, no, it's not really at all.
No, I mean, once you learn this, and you say, oh my gosh, we've been wasting our time.
Well, that was okay because we learned a lot, but the thing that wasn't discouraging was the realization that these are people just like me and I want things. I just don't know what they want, so it's just a question of finding that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So they stripped all this crap away in a sense of what I bring to the thing, let's sit down and bring it right to the situation. It worked very well.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked out an amazing big dam that was built right in the middle of Lac-Compagne across this river that eventually stopped every dry season. And built this big concrete thing that was really, you know, it would put a pretty good lake into that building.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
It's still there. Believe me, I know it's there.
Okay.
Unless they blew it up or something, but I mean, that sucker was built. It was Gary Haynes that built it, the fellow that I mentioned that was killed in an automobile accident.
Yes. Yeah. When he came back home.
Yeah. But when he was an IVSer, he came up there and lived with us, and we built mm-hmm. this dam. It was an amazing project, and for the most part, they understood exactly why we were doing it. They contributed, they helped us mix it, they did the whole thing, and
mm-hmm.
we supplied the material, and we realized probably an urgency that they did not, but they eventually helped us. Well, I don't know if they saw it, but we pleaded with them to help us,
okay.
and they did, and they responded.
Okay.
And it was a well-thought-out project, and Gary knew what the hell he was doing. He knew how strong to make it and all this kind of stuff. It was probably 15 feet tall with sluices in it that you'd let out during the dry
mm-hmm.
season and let
mm-hmm.
that just run. And then in the rainy season, I mean, and then
yeah,
the dry
so
season,
that
just
blow the
put
thing
in these
away.
Big, dropped in these big wooden boards and stuff, dammed it up at the end of the season. So that's a good project.
Yeah.
But that took me years to get that realization that that's sort of what this whole thing's all about. And I think I still carry that. I don't offer too much anymore. And if there's no response, I don't feel bad or push it or anything.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's just a...
I would like to get back just a little bit to the forward area program, because I've been a little bit unsure about that.
Wasn't anything.
When different people would use the same word for what seems to me to be different activities.
Like.
Because I've heard other people say that they were in a forward area, but they seemed to be working in a cluster.
Yeah.
But what I thought I heard you describe was a very temporary, going very quickly.
It's intense.
For the presence.
Right.
To do a variety of things, and it probably varied from place to place.
Almost anything you wanted.
Yeah.
I mean, this is like, okay, priority one type thing, you know? We're going to dig well, okay, we could get all the concrete we wanted.
Yeah.
You know, we get
blast in.
Go in there, do this project and stuff like that to let them know that we care.
And then leave?
And then we'd see what happens, and sometimes we'd go to someplace else and start, you know,
okay.
Do something. It was a, and it was really short-lived, but it was a six-month type thing of you know, I don't know what it was. It was a Hafner's little project.
So when he had the forward area thing, it really was this roving kind of approach.
He had helicopters that he could use to bring us in and see, you know.
Okay, and but that's different from being in a forward area, which would mean away from cities and towns.
We never called the cluster program a forward area program.
Maybe you didn't. Other people have used the term. Because I've heard people say, oh, I was in a forward area.
Uh-uh.
And we had this group of villages that we it was, it's not that you don't know what you're talking about. It's not that I don't know what you're saying, but I've heard, you know, this other thing.
This cluster program, I think, was conceived in like 63.
It seems like a rational way to go about things.
Yeah, and the idea behind it was that there would be a real concentrated thing in there for a couple of years, and we would do all these things for this little area.
Mm-hmm.
Bring them up to the 20th century type of thing, not quite that dramatic, but you know, get in there, these pig programs, and get in there with some agricultural programs, and really get them on their feet type of thing, and then this group would move over to another group of clusters, see, and that's the sequence there, say a 2 to 3 year rotation. Okay.
With different volunteers in and out.
But clearly.
And a variety of skills.
Exactly.
Yes.
And make accessible all the skills that were available in USAID, or USAID, they call it USAID in Laos, and USAM in Thailand, overseas mission versus, and that's the older program. They would then, you know, it was conceived that there wasn't any need to really put additional volunteers back in there, because they figured that would be it, that would be 2 years, and that's where a person would spend their tour and so on, and there wouldn't be any need to go back into those areas because they're sort of developed. Okay. I think Thomas was the guy who was head of rural development in AID who conceived that whole notion. Forgotten his first name. I'm sure he's dead by now. He was an older guy.
Yeah, I mean, to my way of thinking, the idea of a cluster program as outlined is a fairly intelligent way to go. I don't know if I would consider a village developed after 2 or 3 years. I think it might take, you know, much longer
than that.
A
lot of the sites were selected because they hadn't had any presence at all. So there was that concept of forwardness in it. And swear to God, when the sun went down, we were there. We were stuck there.
Mm-hmm.
No way out.
In Colonel Hafner's forward program.
And in the other one, too.
And in the other one
you
as
betcha.
Well. Yeah.
So that's where the forward area comes with. I mean, there was no way you could travel that road at night because you couldn't see the road.
Mm-hmm.
It might be buffalo, you know, there might be ambushers, whatever, you know. I mean, it was just some vast areas that there wasn't any villages or anything, and it was never recommended. I don't remember ever traveling at night.
Right.
You might go up to the local village within the cluster and maybe up there. Even that scared me good a couple of times. There's just no way of, you know, you're right out there in the open. So we never really took many latitudes of that sort of thing. So that's clearly forward. And most volunteers in the field, in the RD program, were in those kinds of settings, connected at night only by radio.
But not in this forward area
Fort Eyre was just a little bit more remote. Yeah.
Yeah.
This was a little more response team. You know, mm-hmm. we just kind of took everything in. We kind of looked to see what we could do.
And
we went into this one
things.
Area called Banuiman that we were in there. We dropped off all our gear. There was a threat of some kind of activity that had gone on about 5 miles away or something like that. Came in the next day, pulled us out. We mm-hmm. left our gear, everything.
Yeah.
Came back in 2 months and picked it all up. Never met anybody.
Mm-hmm. The gear was still there.
We went in. Oh, yeah, everything was there.
Oh.
They just left the house. I mean, we had gone in. Uh-huh. Where can we stay? Is this a vacant house? Yeah, this is a vacant house.
Are you saying goodnight?
I'm going
to go up
and read. Okay. So that was one of the questions that I had, because I had,
yeah.
you know, you had written
had you
cluster
heard
the, and
had,
forward.
Had you ever heard, nobody had mentioned this forward air program at all?
But it always forward seemed area. Like cluster.
Yeah.
And I only had the impression that forward only meant that it was in a relatively dangerous area compared to people further
yeah.
towards
I think,
the cities.
I think it had less to do with danger, okay? As being remote, because
okay.
of the first hint of danger, we were pulled out of there.
Well,
and that was the kind of thing. I mean, you know, danger. I mean, in La Compagne, I say, when the sun went down, we were there.
Yes.
If they wanted to come in and get us, they would have gotten us.
Mm-hmm.
We had no defense. We weren't armed. We weren't, you know. And as far as I know, well, we did have that happen once.
What happened?
We had an incursion of some kind come
oh.
through. And one of the Lao guys came over and said to me that if anything happens, I will be the first to come and tell you so that we can leave and go in the forest. You know,
mm-hmm.
that only happened once. And we, you know, that's all. It was just one time. And that was in La Compagne.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing ever happened, and we forgot about it, so to speak.
Yeah.
So I was never in any, the only time I was in any real physical danger over there was we'd been out in the field at night. We were doing some blasting because we were doing an irrigation ditch over in Saravan. You know, we did a lot of funny things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, we had to blow away this hill in order to get this ditch to go through there, and so we were out there just like John Brown, you know, in the old with sledgehammers and these big long
mm-hmm.
driving tools,
mm-hmm.
drilling holes in rock and pushing them full of dynamite and blowing up the hill. And we came in kind of late at night, and we came in, and that's the first time I ever realized that I could have been shot, because we came up to this checkpoint, a Lao checkpoint,
uh-huh.
and drove right up to it, and the guy had taken his gun and went just like that and telling us to stop. Well, we just kept going because we thought he knew who we were, you know, just in a vehicle, and he damn near shot us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's the only time that I personally was ever really, you know,
mm-hmm.
by getting shot by your own people. That could happen here. But
yes,
I never felt a sense of insecurity. And yet, when I went to Thailand, I did sense that. You know what I mean? When I crossed the border and got into town, I realized there wasn't any war going on over there type of thing when I was in IDS. We would cross over periodically right in the middle of nowhere up there. Just take a boat across and go into some little village on the other side of Laos or Thailand and just go for the day.
And you felt insecure there?
No, I felt okay there. It was like this is
oh,
war.
Oh, that you've come
that
out
kind
of the war zone and,
well,
you, and
sort of,
you are
yeah,
now
you,
it
you
back
are
into
more aware of this than you were.
Mm-hmm,
once you
mm-hmm.
crossed the Mekong, everything was okay, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That would happen every time. And I don't know why that was, except that it's just in your mind that that's the case.
I'm looking for something that you wrote in your survey thing. Let me pause here for just a second while I find. You wrote relationship with the people in your assignment,
mm-hmm.
that you lived in their village and they included you in all their celebrations and religious activities.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like a period. They protected us, looked after our stuff, and worked with us in all of the activities we initiated in the cluster villages. But they protected us. What did you mean?
They
there?
Knew what was going on. We didn't.
Okay.
That's basically a concept of we're all vulnerable. If somebody wants to come in and get you, they can.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, we always were, you know, the fact. I'm sure the Pathet Lao knew where we were.
Yeah.
Not necessarily me, but I mean, you know, they knew that we were, an IVS was out there.
Uh-huh.
And I think at that time I knew that our security, if we're going to get through this, in a sense, we're going to have the rapport of the people and so on. And if we don't have that, we won't have their protection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of thing. And it's really a very simple sort of thing. In other words, I would take excursions, go out and get wood up into the mountains with my guys for building stuff.
Uh-huh.
And they would tell me where to go.
And where not to go.
And where not to go.
Mm-hmm.
And they would tell me what to eat. Tell me what to eat.
Okay.
And what not to eat.
Yeah.
And they would find things and they would say, here, this is really good. Or something. You know, that's what I meant. I mean, it was a very general thing. We were there and they could have done anything. It's like, and I trusted them to do that. And I had no reason not to. And I would never have any reason not to.
Yeah.
Because that was the agreement. If I couldn't trust these people, I couldn't live there. And for that reason, they protected me.
Yeah, and I was thinking of the protection more in the security sense, that they had their ears to the ground. They knew if it was likely that the Patela were coming close and they or would go in a place where you were thinking of going, and they'd warn you off.
Yeah, and though we didn't, we were pretty callous about that, or careless, I should say, careless about that,
mm-hmm.
because we really didn't check with them.
Maybe as often as you really should have.
Well, you know, I didn't check with them hardly at all. We just kind of, you know. The thing that I'm getting at here is the realization that in knowing what I found out when I studied the, you know, insurgency organization, there was the fact that in the concept of a protracted war, they would never attack us.
The
Patet Lao, whoever was there, they would never attack us unless they had their people in place, their guerrilla squads in place, and they could afford to draw us out. And in fact, that's eventually what happened. And when they attacked the IBSers and killed several of them in a period of about a month or two or something in there, what happened? Pull all the people in.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly what they wanted. And they planned that. I know they planned that. I mean, I didn't see any documentation on this, but that's exactly what...
That's the pattern.
That's what they wanted. Yeah, that's the pattern. That's what they would do.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't know that for sure. They just knew... I mean, we might come back and just hammer the hell out of them, too. See? Might bring in Marines or something like
mm-hmm.
that. Well, they didn't know that, but they knew that they could at least defend themselves to some extent from the Marines if that were happening, see. But you don't go around drawing attention to yourself when you... are really trying to build your organization. And they were doing what I saw later in Thailand they were doing. They were killing school teachers, constables, that they couldn't bring over to their side, scare or whatever, or just use as demonstrators.
And that's what they were doing,
that's
in
doing
Laos
when I was there.
When you were there, yes.
And that's just building their organization.
Mm, well, or destroying the other organization while they're
building their
own.
Organization,
yeah.
Same thing.
Yeah.
And discrediting.
Well, defense and offense
taking,
are two
yeah, they
different
would,
parts.
With that kind of thing, see, they could take out somebody and the Lao would do the same thing, pull back a little bit. So that left them what they wanted. They could now have this area because they had rice and they needed
mm-hmm.
food and they needed recruits and they needed
mm-hmm.
water and they needed safe places and so on and so on.
Mm-hmm. But at least the villagers, by protecting you, you know, they weren't keeping you from the possibility of stumbling onto
a
group of Patet Lao,
I think, I'm not,
for example.
For example, that might be the case, but I think what I was talking about was the fact that if somebody wants to come in and get you, they would have had a tough time, but I'm not so sure, you know, to come in and get somebody if, in fact, you've got everybody knowing who you are and everybody sort of realize that this might happen.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to get informed on. Okay? When it's an armed group like this, you know, a dedicated group, they can probably operate with impunity because they're so well armed in respect to what's going on. I mean, in one case, one of the IVSers died. The guy walks into the bottom of the house, sprays the floor
mm-hmm.
with his, you know, with his AK, and leaves. And you know, this guy is dead upstairs. You know, I mean, what would have stopped them from coming and doing that to me? Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely nothing. I'm on a main road. There's dark. There's no street lights or anything like that. I mean, dark night. They could just come in and do that with impunity. I thought there was some semblance of, you know, rapport or something. But I mean, this is a lot more serious than I thought it was. And the fact that the fact that, that I was operating on that, I should have been scared to death to be out there to some extent, because mm-hmm. that could have happened. They could have gone from step four to step five, which means clear obstacles out of the area, you know, which yeah. would be us, you know. And the way you do that is you just kill a couple of us, and that'll pull us all back, because nobody could protect us.
Yeah. I was thinking also that they might hesitate from doing that simply because they recognize that you weren't at least an immediate threat to them, and that you were at least were attempting to do something for the people there, and the people appreciated you. So why bring grief upon themselves with the people that they're trying to control and manipulate by killing you?
Mm-hmm.
There's just no gain.
Yeah. It really wouldn't have served any purpose, because it would have drawn attention to them. And they didn't want to do that. Yeah.
Well, and it also would have made the local people of the village maybe resent them, or at least...
They didn't care about that. They don't
at
care
least
about
not, not,
no.
not go with
if you
them.
Can't get them, you can terrorize them. And they didn't have any qualm about either of those. They really wanted the things that they needed, and that was recruits, which you can get through compromise. Water, which is there, all you do is take it, and the food, they could take it if they wanted to. Whether you're going to give it to me or you're not, doesn't matter to them.
Mm. But don't they need the support of the people?
No. Not necessarily.
Not necessarily?
No. You can scare most of them in that. You know, that's Mao's thing about, you know, political power comes in the barrel of a gun. It's really true.
He also disciplined his troops in the sense of treating the people properly so that they would be supportive, in other words, of not turning government informers.
That's true, but they scared them so bad it didn't matter. I mean, the government was so insipid that there really wasn't any way that the government could retaliate. They operated with impunity. The only problem they really had in Laos was the fact that the Lao don't go to discipline real easily, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, you can train somebody, but he might just up and say, hey, my rice fields need to be done, so he goes home.
Mm-hmm.
And he would. Or I'm really, Keith Ban, you know, I want to go home to my house. I'm thinking about my house so much I just can't work anymore, I got to go home to my house.
Uh-huh.
You know, that kind of thing. And that's what happened. And they're just that way.
Mm.
And so the idea that you're going to move the Lao, they had just as many problems as we did, if you can think about turning the tide here. And incidentally, what I hear is that the Laos are basically what they were years ago.
Yeah.
I could go back to my village,
uh-huh.
and basically it would be, well, not my village. My village got bombed by
really?
The U.S., yes. That's the sort of realization of how naive or how idealistic I was. When Nixon, I was in Thailand at the time, I was in Udon, and he ran that thing across the Parrot's Peak there trying to break into the Great Command and stuff like that. Well, what that did for Laos is that instead of the trails coming down pretty much down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, they've spread out over the Mekong Delta, which was pretty much Laos.
Yeah.
Instead of going down the mountains and stuff, they just came across the lowlands there.
Right,
and
the
so
southern panhandle
exactly.
Of Laos.
Exactly, so they blanched out. Well, that's Pak Say. Pak Say is over quite a bit because it's on the
yep.
river. But north of there, they came over into areas like Khon Sae Dawn and so on. And what happened wasn't so much what the Viet Cong used that as the Ho Chi Minh Trail, but the Americans classified that whole area as a free fire zone. So when their guys came back from Vietnam with their air ordnance and stuff, and
they
saw
just
things
got
like
rid of it there.
Yeah, they blew my village apart.
Hmm.
That's my village, you know. I mean, you know what I'm saying. I mean, I was in Udon at the time. That's where the flights came from, and I was a member of the officers' club. So I went over to talk to some of these guys. What kind of guerrillas they must be, you know? And you know, they were just like me.
Mm-hmm.
They're scared to death. They were just doing their job. I mean, they hoped that every time they'd left, they hoped like hell they'd be back. A lot of them didn't get back, you know?
No.
I mean, there wasn't any, did you work over there? Oh, gee, I'm really sorry. I hope I didn't do anything to you, you know, and that kind of thing.
Or you mean on their part?
Their part, yeah.
Well, they didn't see anything drop. They just saw it leave their plane, but they
I
didn't see
I know that,
see
but
it
I'm
yet.
Just saying, they aren't meaning to kill people and do things bad. Neither did I. You know, I mean, I was interested in helping the people. Did I help the people? Not really. You know, It's that kind of thing, you know.
But you weren't flying the plane. I mean, they were flying the plane. I mean,
I'd have to agree with Lou. You know, the duplicity is overwhelming here. You know, was I? You know, I realize that. But if I had been not had this IBS experience, very likely, I wasn't going to Canada. I couldn't do that. I was going. I'd be in the Marines.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I had decent eyesight, maybe I'd have been a Marine pilot.
Uh-huh.
And that's what I'd have been doing. That's what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that I couldn't have done everything that was just as atrocious. I don't know. That's the guilt.
Yeah.
If you can do what I did, which is be there, you know, and go along with this whole thing, why wouldn't, given different shoes, there go I, you know, I mean, that kind of thing. I mean, I feel that way, and I think that's probably so. I'm not any stronger or weaker than the next guy. In fact, I met some just incredible, like Hafner. Hafner was just a tower of a man.
Mm-hmm.
You could sit and talk to him, and he had all these doubts and questions, and still, you know, we just have to do what we can, you know?
Uh-huh.
I felt a lot of kinship with just oodles and oodles of people, and I didn't see, you know, some government doing this. I saw individual AID people making decisions, and I saw airmen, pilots, that sort of thing, wanting to go home, getting their time in, doing their thing. You met a few macho guys. Some of those guys, the most courageous people I ever saw in my life. I mean, they didn't, they just flew. Some of those helicopter pilots were unbelievable. You know?
Yeah, but also...
See, I can't judge that because I could have been there. See, that's what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
I could have done almost anything that's there. I don't know how... given their circumstances, and when you talk to them, and they say, well, I don't know what else to do, you know, I mean, that's my job. I mean, I'd be court-martialed or something. I mean, that's what we're doing here, isn't it? And then, but if you put them on the ground and put them through my experience, they'd see how bad that was. But you'd have to do that in order for them to see that. As far as America's concerned, and the job that they did back here and the way we think about ourselves, those people aren't people. Because we don't know them. There's not that compassion in America for people who are different than Americans.
I know that.
But I mean, in a sense, that's what I sense. I sense that we demonize that situation so bad over there that we justified almost anything.
That's what happens in war.
Yeah.
You make the enemy the despised other.
Right, and deface them. You don't give them names. You give them terrible, you know, slanders. Whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, you could just watch George Bush do this just before the Gulf War.
Before the Gulf War. Yeah, mm-hmm. And you watch Adolf Hitler do it to the Jews before they put them in the ovens.
Right. The propagandists just work. Yeah, exactly.
But
we did that with the slope heads and the.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but.
Gooks and pushing people around, we did.
Yeah, but that doesn't make it...
Make it a free fire zone. Is there anything that moves down there is fine. You know, we don't bring the ordnance back in on the base.
Yeah. Anyway.
I know. I mean, that's where I came to. And I'm all the only thing I'm saying to you is this, that my guilt comes from the fact that we don't have an alternative for stopping this sort of thing. Once we get into this kind of mode, we just kind of go on.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that I got this incredibly unique experience of working at all levels, from the base on down to the top, when I worked in Thailand, was a gift that was given to me to sort of look at all this.
Okay? But didn't it make you want to stop the bombing of your village?
I was outraged by the fact that this had happened.
Yeah, and how was that possible? Like it?
And then when they told me how it happened.
Mm-hmm.
I understood, and it was a terrible,
but that
terrible
make
tragedy.
It right.
No, it never made it right.
Yeah.
It was terribly wrong. But that's the way it works, you know?
If we let it happen.
It's all, you know, it continues to happen. We did it in the Gulf War.
as long as you don't speak up. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that would be part of it. I mean, I always wondered what I would have done had I been here. And I found out what I would do if I was here when during the Gulf War, because I was out on the street and I was again, you know, was screaming about this thing and writing letters to the editor about how, and to my senator and stuff like this. I mean, I stopped my work. I went to my customers and said, I can't work. I got to deal with this. I mean, I've become a pacifist. This does not solve problems. This is only destroys things.
Yeah, it makes things worse. Yeah. Yeah, that's what we kind of eventually have to do, because otherwise it will continue.
Yeah, and it does continue.
Yeah.
So that's why the philosophy thing, I mean, it's the ideas that we use and we put to these things that makes us do this type of thing. It's not some psychological thing about we have testosterone or some hormonal thing or anything. It's just the way we think about each other and the way we make decisions about what we're going to think about and stuff. And that's why it's the quest here. I'm sure it's there.
I don't want to talk about the testosterone ideas. That's just a little bit loopy, and you know, etc.
No, but you know, I'm just saying, it's the way we sort of socialize and organize ourselves, and that's the contrast I'm trying to draw here, because I realized our two villages were the same. Rembrandt was the same as this village that I worked in, and
it was so
unbelievable
that it was almost like your hometown.
It was. I knew these people as well, and I could, except for location, they were the same, and that's what I felt. And I worked under that premise when I went to Thailand, in the sense that all these kinds of ideas about we can't go in and do what they do. We've got to represent ourselves as policemen, the best policemen type of thing. And this is the kind of stuff that was in this course about you've got to be, you know, have the rapport of the people on this.
This is, of course, you mean, just for the sake of the tape, this was post-IVS when you were working in Thailand.
Correct.
Under, I guess, an AID contracting, right?
Right.
With the Thai police and developing materials for them.
It was the Thai National Border Police.
Border
Police. And their mission was to work on the insurgency and so on. And I was assigned to the training center at Hua Hin to develop a program in counterinsurgency.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, but that's coming out of my experience in Laos, basically.
And said, this is how it should be.
This is how it must be.
And it was based on your observations of the mistakes that we were making in the years when you were a volunteer and then a little bit later.
Most of it came out of the IVS realization that in living in the village, that you have to know that village. I mean, the emphasis would be on patrol people saying, well, if you don't know the language of that village, you better damn well start recruiting those kinds of people into the police force so that they can work in that village.
That's right.
We must be able to access the village as people.
And we see that here in the United States with patterns
with the
of
community
of
police.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Just coming around. We had that stuff in the 60s.
Yeah. And Clinton saying we need more police, you know, and other people saying, no, we need more savings for the rich. to buy security systems.
Yeah, exactly.
And let the poor kill each other.
Communities with the fences around us.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. But well, we're not too far off of the stuff that was going on 30 years ago for me. And the questions that you raise and the questions that I raise constantly and see here are exactly the same question. We've not resolved these, and we are not about to, but we need to work on these, and it's not a lot different.
Yeah, because it destroys communities, whether there or here.
Right, and I think that at the time that I went into IVS, I was fully cognizant of what I was doing, why I was doing it. I think I operated out of a great deal of respect for the people that I worked with. In fact, awe. Of the Lao that I worked with, and I just was so astonished at their, you know, wonderful personalities and this sort of thing. I mean, it was an incredibly enlightening experience for me. I mean, I was just shocked at I don't know how you can be so far away. I mean, I can't think of anything further. I mean, if I took a Lao person out of one of those villages and he went with me and we flew to New York City, I mean, that would show the contrast. He would be so far out of his element. That's what I felt when I went to Laos at first, and it never really became that. In other words, I never felt like an alien there at all.
Mm-hmm. Even though you entered as one.
Well, even though I was a stranger.
Yeah.
And clearly very different than anything they really sat down with and talked to. Really amazing. Absolutely amazing. I mean, nothing was ever stolen from our home. It was wide open. There were doors.
Mine too. Yeah.
It wasn't...
Well, we had one guy who would borrow things all the time. So when we would leave for a week or two, we'd come back and, oh, Narciso's got this, that, and the other. Yeah. Then we'd go to his house. We'd carry it all back.
Yeah, exactly.
And then set it up again. And right. But he had it. I mean, we knew where to go to get it.
It wasn't like he had to steal it because he knew he could borrow it.
Yeah. You know? He could borrow it any time he wanted
exactly.
to.
Exactly.
You know?
And we operated that way. And it was... it was an experience that I think of. I mean, when I talk about community now and my my interest in that particular area, the reference is in that of this being able to solve like almost 100% of the problems that we face can be dealt with within a group of people who have the problem.
As long as they are a community.
Well, they become one through those processes and through those dealings with those kinds of issues. The fact that we have all these other organizations, we've given them the rules and so on to do these, is, I think, a mistake in large part because we don't have that. But anyway, that's...
I'm going to put this a little back on track, but first, I've got it off pause now.
Okay.
Because I've had the pause that refreshes. And
you'll know
we'll take
that
this
means.
Off pause. Oh, I'm going to put it on for just a second again.
Okay.
On now again. And go through a few things. You were saying, though, I thought about turning this back on because you were saying something I think fairly important about the opportunity that IVS gave you to not just an opportunity to become engaged in voluntarism, but to challenge you to become involved in voluntarism.
Right. It was I think it came, there was a lot of things. I mean, you go into something like this with lots of expectations about different things, and the things that actually came out of the experience are the ones that in reflection you find that's exactly what, that you could affect things. You could change things by virtue of knowing a lot about them, and in a sense,
the local folks that you were sent to
local,
to live
local
with.
I mean, it became really clear that what was lasting and what possibly might be lasting might be just the realization that we went there at all, and
mm-hmm.
that we had enough interest to go and spend our time there, and that we listened to them, and that we were willing to live with them, and they saw in us that hands across the sea. It's an incredible symbol that they put on all the AID stuff, but in a sense, it was an opportunity for us to meet people at that level, and
mm-hmm.
I think what I got from that was